Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is your host, Travis Hornsby. Today, we're going to talk about what happened with the midterms and what it means for student loans going forward. And we're also going to talk about student loan cancellation. And specifically, we're going to talk about the court case that's blocking student loan cancellation and what does that mean next for everyone's student loans. You know, I think it has really big implications, even if you wouldn't benefit from cancellation that much, because it's going to certainly impact student loan policy writ large, and it's going to be a big deal no matter what. Let's talk first about the blocking of student loan cancellation with that lawsuit in Texas, and what does that mean for student loans? For those of you that haven't been following this particularly closely, the student loan cancellation program that President Biden put forward in August is now blocked and suspended, eliminated, temporarily pending appeal. A separate court case was filed in Texas. Everyone was focused on the one that is currently in the Eighth Circuit right now. That case started out in the Eastern District of Missouri, and the judge basically dismissed it and said nobody had standing. And the argument in that case, you know, that was filed by six Republican-led states, and mostly in the Midwest. Those states essentially argued, hey, we're going to be negatively impacted with our tax revenues. We're going to also, MOHELA is going to be negatively impacted, which is an arm of the state of Missouri, and therefore Missouri can sue on behalf of MOHELA. So the argument was that nobody had standing on the government side, and no one was harmed, basically, because MOHELA would have had to sue on their own. And Representative Cori Bush, who represents St. Louis, got a letter out of MOHELA basically saying that they did not intend to be a part of the lawsuit. They were not involved in it in any way. And so that case was at least wobbling a little bit, but the judges on that court did decide to issue a sort of an administrative stay, which is like a pause. They can't cancel any debt until they rule on whether or not there's going to be an injunction. So that was the status of the Eighth Circuit Court case, and everybody was focused on that one because that was perhaps the most organized, perhaps you could say the best funded, the best resourced. That was the primary case that was drawing people's attention. So I have to admit that I even missed this. I would like to maybe place some of the blame on the chaos in my personal life with trying to figure out the logistics of bringing a baby home, possibly on oxygen from the hospital. So I'm not as deep into texting all the other student loan experts I know, trying to get their thoughts like as I maybe normally am. And so I definitely missed this in the last newsletter update because I thought after the midterms being a little bit more better for Democrats than was anticipated, you know, that would maybe mean the cancellation would be a little safer, actually. But I did not see this Texas lawsuit coming out of left field. And that's what happens with student loans sometimes. You can really have a really good understanding of the rules, and then something very unexpected pops you in the face. So what exactly happened with this? The Job Creators Network is a right-leaning organization that had said that they were going to try to block student loan cancellation from the start. So this is an organization that is funded by the co-founder of Home Depot. They are big financial backers of sort of right-leaning causes, and they waited to file their lawsuit until later in the process compared to some of the ones that were filed. So if you recall, there was one filed by Pacific Legal Foundation that was basically put up by a borrower that was Indiana who was going to have to pay state income taxes, and the administration responded quickly to say, well, actually, people can opt out of this, and so you won't get taxes on cancellation, and therefore you don't have standing. And so that case got blocked because of that. And then another case in Wisconsin was basically saying, hey, giving cancellation, they seized on some remarks by the White House press secretary that said that this was going to help close the racial wealth gap. And this Wisconsin taxpayer group sued, stating that that was a violation of the 14th Amendment that guarantees equal protection under the law, regardless of race or ethnic background. And the courts found that that didn't have standing, that that wasn't a legitimate argument. And so those were two cases that were shot down. Those were, we thought, less serious than the, you know, the Republican Attorney General lawsuit, just because that they had that MOHELA part of their argument, which was, you know, you could make a good argument that MOHELA is not part of the state of Missouri, that it's a separate entity, that Missouri would not have the authority to sue on behalf of MOHELA, that MOHELA would have to decide to sue independently. But that is a big question. And, a right-leaning court might decide that they do have the power to sue on behalf of MOHELA. And that would certainly be an impacted organization financially by student loan cancellation. And there was a lot weaker arguments that those states had about, you know, having negative impacts from state tax revenue that they wouldn't get. Like if the loans were canceled later than after the American Rescue Plan expires, it makes student loan forgiveness tax-free on a federal level, that they would have 1099s issued to borrowers, and the states would be able to collect taxes on that. So those were less strong arguments. Another argument they made, which was actually key in the success of this Texas lawsuit, is they made an argument that Nebraska invested in some FFEL loans and basically stated that by giving an incentive to consolidate, that the state of Nebraska's pension funds would lose money in their investments because these bonds were trading, you know, I think above par probably, which means that they would be marked down when they would be consolidated. Now, Department of Education actually offered to pay above par, from what I understand, on those FFEL loans to try to ward off lawsuits. I'm not sure exactly how they did that, because that's, you know, I would assume that that would require some sort of appropriation. Somebody who knows more about this than I do said that some departments have large amounts of discretionary funds that they're able to allocate in a way that the secretary sees fit. And so that was kind of what they were doing with that. But of course, Nebraska wasn't interested in receiving back the market value of the investment. They were using this to try to block the student loan cancellation. And what the Department of Ed did very intelligently and necessarily is they said, okay, well, anybody who consolidates after September 29th, 2022 is not going to be included in this cancellation plan because we cannot provide an ongoing incentive to consolidate. And that was really the thing that ended up being key in this judge who was appointed by George W. Bush shooting down the lawsuit at that Eastern District of Missouri level. So basically the judge said, hey, I agree with the government here that since there's no ongoing incentive to consolidate because you took the commercially held FFEL loans issued before 2010 out of this student debt relief program, that means that the plaintiffs don't have an argument, because he found that Mohila had to sue on its own if they wanted to sue, that Mohila didn't have, or Missouri didn't have the right to sue on behalf of Mohila. He found the arguments about state tax revenue losses to be weak. And he found that since there was no ongoing incentive to consolidate, that nobody had standing to block it. Of course, the people in that lawsuit immediately appealed it to the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit's one of the most conservative courts in the whole country. If you think about the composition, I believe there's only one justice on the Eighth Circuit of Appeals that's appointed by a Democratic president. And so they issued a temporary pause on this, you know, actual bringing of relief. Really, the theory that pretty much everybody, I think, pro and against student loan cancellation has is once it starts going out the door, there's no stopping it and there's no reversing it. That's what happened. They issued a pause on student loan cancellation, and notably, they actually didn't make any ruling on a more permanent injunction until after the election, which is really interesting. I think that if you are tend to be left-leaning, I think you would argue that was very intentional to not hurt Republican candidates. If you are more right-leaning, you might say that they needed appropriate amount of time to, you know, decide this case or something. I don't know. I mean, to me, it certainly does feel like the goal that the Eighth Circuit had was to not give either side sort of a win before the election. I think you could make a reasonable argument that it certainly seems to be in line with a right-leaning bent on the way that they would rule on that. Now, in terms of the decision from that court, what that did is that gummed up cancellation and stopped it from happening and gave time for the court in Texas to make their own ruling independently of what this case was being decided in the Eighth Circuit. So let's talk about this Texas case. Remember earlier I said that this lawsuit down in Texas was funded by this conservative right-leaning group, and they found two key borrowers that were impacted in a negative way. And why did I go down that rabbit hole? So remember that the administration had to stop people with commercially held debt that didn't consolidate by September 29th. They blocked them from getting cancellation under the program. So what they did is this conservative group found someone who had commercially held FFEL debt that would have qualified for the program if they had consolidated before September 29th. And since they didn't consolidate, they were left out of the program. The group brought forward this challenger who said, hey, I didn't get my cancellation. This is a violation because I was harmed economically by not getting cancellation because of this arbitrary decision by the Department of Ed. They found somebody else who also sued based off of being a non-Pell Grant borrower that also said, hey, I only got $10,000 cancellation. I should be getting $20,000 like everyone else because this program was arbitrarily decided. If we think about what is going on here, clearly you would not agree to have your name used in a lawsuit to try to stop student loan cancellation unless you were very personally opposed to it, right? They had to find two people that were very opposed to student loan cancellation that did not mind putting their names forward as plaintiffs to try to stop it. Because these two individuals were, you know, definitely harmed by the Department of Education's design of the program, that gave an opening for a Trump-appointed judge in Texas in a federal court there, a lower-level federal court, to say, hey, look, these two individuals were harmed economically, and so now I can proceed to the merits of the case. I think if you're more of a Democratic-leaning nature, you would say that's a ridiculous interpretation of standing. If somebody can say, hey, I was harmed by an agency decision economically, then basically every single agency decision around the country could be challenged this way. I'm not going to make a definitive statement on standing because I'm not a lawyer. You know, I mean, certainly I talked to a lot of friends that are lawyers and they think that the standing argument is ridiculous. I don't see that many like conservative leaning people saying that the standing argument is great, but I'll say that, you know, that they got over that hurdle. This particular judge got over that hurdle of, hey, can anybody legitimately challenge this by saying that they were economically harmed? And they identified these two borrowers. So then the judge basically went straight to the merits of the case and said, hey, because I'm able to rule on the merits of the case, because I found these two people that were harmed, because there's this prior court case that says, you know, individuals that are harmed by, you know, an agency's action can bring a lawsuit, so I can look at the merits of the case. That was basically what the problem with the Eastern Court of Missouri. They basically said, well, yeah, this program from the merits of the case might not be super legal, but I can't make a ruling on that because I need to have standing. Somebody needs to have standing for me to make a ruling on that. So this judge kind of made the different decision of, hey, yeah, I have their standing of these two borrowers that were harmed, and then I'm going to rule on the merits. And so what they said on the merits of the case is that student loan cancellation, in this judge's view, does not line up with what the HEROES Act allows. So the HEROES Act, you know, you don't have to go through the normal rulemaking process to make rules. What this judge says is, no, this is not a fair use of the HEROES Act, and therefore, if the administration wanted to do this, they would have had to go through the public comment period. And since they didn't go through the public comment period, they're in violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. And because of that, and because of the major questions doctrine, which basically says that judges can have judicial review over items of great economic and political significance, that's been something that was looked at with an EPA case, some other cases as well. And so basically this judge found that because the merits of the case were, in this judge's words, a major abuse of legislative authority by the executive branch, that the whole program was null and void and the program was suspended and over. So this was not even an injunction. The judge basically said student loan cancellation is over. It's not legal. Move on. Of course, the Biden administration immediately appealed this ruling to the Fifth Circuit. So now we have two cases on student loan cancellation, the Eighth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit. Now, the Fifth Circuit is one of the other most conservative appeals courts in the country. So there's only a handful of folks appointed or judges appointed by Democratic presidents on this Court of Appeals. That means that you're going to probably see this get appealed to the Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit both have two different legal arguments that they can use to stop student loan cancellation. This is something that conservative legal minds are very, very opposed to. I mean, kind of makes sense why a conservative-leaning judge would be opposed to this, just because of, you know, separation of powers, Congress has power of the purse, this is spending $400-600 billion without Congress, and a conservative-leaning judge wouldn't like that. And what I would expect to happen next is the Eighth Circuit or the Fifth Circuit is going to say, hey, this student loan program is not legal. We could very see a split ruling. The Eighth Circuit might say, hey, there's no standing here. We're dismissing the challenge. And the Fifth Circuit could say, hey, we find that these two borrowers were injured and we're upholding the lower court ruling. So you would get conflicting rulings. But even if you didn't get conflicting rulings, even if the Eighth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit did not decide in favor of the government, it's going to get appealed. It's going to get appealed no matter what, basically, right? If these appeals courts find in favor of the plaintiffs and say the student loan program is illegal, you know, then it's going to get appealed. And then if the lower courts find that the program is legal, then opponents of the program are going to appeal it. What's really obvious to me now is student loan lawsuits are all going to end up at the Supreme Court at some point. And with the composition of the court that obviously was willing to overturn Roe v. Wade, I would be pretty surprised if the Supreme Court upheld student loan cancellation now. So the big question was, is anybody going to find standing to challenge student loan cancellation? You have to have a plaintiff that was economically harmed to bring a lawsuit that's successful, period. And that's why everybody was assuming that maybe this cancellation is actually going to happen. But now that there's at least one court that's found, yes, there's standing, and yes, this program is unconstitutional, I would be very surprised now if it happens the way that it was expected to happen. I kind of missed the mark on this. I just want to admit that, like, because in a newsletter update I gave last week, I said, hey, you know, Democrats did much better in the midterms. If they do end up holding the House or coming very close to holding the House, you know, you might have a House GOP that's a little chastened and not willing to challenge student loan cancellation in court. And if nobody can prove that they have standing, then maybe this cancellation is upheld and it happens. And certainly industry groups want this to happen, because what's going to come next is going to be real chaotic. And so I'll tell you why I think groups like a SoFi or Nelnet haven't sued, right? Because those are corporate entities that are negatively harmed by student loan cancellation and a lot of the different student loan relief actions taken by the Biden administration. So you can, if you're looking for somebody with economic injury, there's definitely private entities out there that originate private loans, refinance student loans, you know, service student loans, that could all make an argument they were economically harmed and sue to block any of these different measures. But why have they not done that? And the reason is because you essentially have this political just nightmare if you're a Democratic president, where now you might say maybe it's not as much of a nightmare anymore, because any kind of argument that student loan cancellation is a political albatross might not really hold water anymore. If you really look at the midterm elections, it might have even helped the Democrats, right? You might not care as much anymore, like you might have pre-midterms in terms of, you know, is student loan cancellation in a big scale a good idea politically, right? But if you're a Democratic president with Biden, I mean, Biden was going to start student loans again in January of 2022, right? He was going to start them up. He said, this is the final pause. And then what happened? Build Back Better fell apart. It was a signature legislation. Progressives were furious over this. The mainstream Democrats were also furious over this, and they wanted action on something the president could control. And the student loan pause was something that he could control. And so therefore, he changed his mind and extended the student loan pause and then extended it again. And what is clear, right, is Joe Biden wants to run again for president. And so what do you need to run again for president? Support. And if he had been wiped out, if his party had been wiped out in the midterms, you know, it'd be pretty hard to make an argument for him being the nominee in 2024, but because his party did really well for any compared to any other Democratic president in recent memory in the past 50 years, he's got a decent argument of being renominated, right? And so his restarting of student loan payments was really contingent upon canceling all this debt so that they could get rid of the spike in defaults that everybody knows is going to happen. Because if you take away a bill for a month, what do people do? Well, you get some relief, and then you know the bill's coming back, and so you keep that in your budget. If you pause the bill for a year, what do you do? Well, you're still getting some relief. Maybe you go out and you buy some like temporary items, some big ticket items like a car, a vacation, you know, some sort of more moderate expense, right? Like a new bike or something, or a new playset for your kids, depending on how much student loans you have. But if you have a pause that goes on for multiple years, which is what we've had, you start like adjusting your budget. You start saying, you know what? I don't really think this bill's going to come back, particularly if you have, I would say, less awareness of what's going on in the student loan kind of world, which graduate degree holders, professional degree holders tend to have the most awareness of what's going on in the student loan world, just because of virtue of being more educated, right? Being more privileged than folks with less education and lower income levels. What a lot of people have done, what millions of people have done, is they have written off student loans in their mind from their budgets. And so we know that defaults are going to spike whenever they do turn on student loans again. The question is how much will it spike? And so the Biden administration definitely wanted to avoid this economic pain and avoid this negative headline, especially given the polarization of education levels across the different parties, right? Because, you know, if you look at college-educated voters, there's greater polarization between the parties now than ever before, where college-educated voters are more likely to be Democrats and non-college-educated voters are more likely to be Republicans. So this is a group of voters that is super important to the Democratic Party. Also tends to be younger voters, borrowers of color disproportionately, that would be impacted by this. So the administration needs to take care of this group of borrowers. This is a way that they could get out of the trap they were in, where nobody wants to start repayments again. The only reward they're going to get from starting repayments again is just a lower budget deficit and possibly very slightly lower inflation. And some people argue that that's not the case. There wouldn't even be that much inflation if they didn't restart payments. There's not a big reward for being the let's turn on student loans again kind of person, right? And so this was the way where the Biden administration could get out of the tough spot they're in of turning on payments again while also not having these defaults spike and also being able to claim, hey, we're not giving this benefit to high-income people. This is for working people because we're limiting it to only 10 or 20,000. We're going to give it to only people that make below 125,000 a year. We're going to give more to people that had Pell Grants because they're lower-income people who need it more. This whole thing was very crafted to try to fit within the parameters of what they thought that they could do politically. And I think that people before the midterms, too, thought that this was a losing proposition. I think people looked at cancellation and they thought, hey, you know, Democrats were struggling with working class voters. A bad idea is to look even more pro highly educated voters if we're trying to win over this group of people. There was a lot of skepticism. If you look at people like Tim Ryan, like Maggie Hassan, I believe Cortez Masto in Nevada, people that were in these sort of swing states, those folks in general opposed student loan cancellation. They didn't support it publicly, which is telling because they believed that it was a losing issue. Otherwise, they would have supported it, most likely. Let's talk about the midterms a little bit and why all this blocking of student loan cancellation might result in people that are going for forgiveness to get basically, I would say, more money saved than if you might have gotten direct cancellation, depending on how they end up doing it. So let's talk about that. The midterm elections, Democrats did much better than expected. Why is that? If you look at the pundits, and I am not a political analyst, but I like to read a lot of this stuff for fun, and so I'm just going to parrot what people have said. If you look at states where, you know, abortion rights and democracy were not as much at risk, like New York and Florida, Republicans performed very much in line with what you would expect in a midterm that's, you know, happening when there's the other party in power. So Republicans beat expectations in Florida, beat expectations in New York in terms of their vote share. And in those kind of states, there wasn't a risk of, you know, abortion getting curtailed. What's interesting is if you look at DeSantis, who really outperformed expectations, would not be perhaps what media would describe as a outright election denier, and also he was not willing to go more intense on abortion restrictions than 15 weeks compared to some other governors that were willing to go more restrictive than that. This is what pundits have said, right? Is that if you look at these states where Republicans did better, it's these states where abortion and democracy were not key issues. But if you look at states where they were key issues, Republicans really underperformed. Those were kind of the big key issues in the midterms, what people are saying is, you know, abortion and democracy. And secondarily, people noticed that there was not abysmal young voter turnout. And a lot of people are saying that this is due to a couple things. They're not saying it's just one issue, but they're saying climate action, and they're saying student loan cancellation are kind of the big things that people are saying as to why young voters turned out in decent enough numbers to prevent this from being a red wave election. What that's kind of suggesting is that student loan cancellation is a winning issue because Democrats, at a minimum, they were not punished for it. And you can make an argument that they were rewarded for it because young voters showed up, not in massive numbers, but, you know, in good enough numbers for a midterm that it wasn't a bad election for them. And so if you're, you know, Biden looking at this and you get blocked from your signature student loan relief via the cancellation plan, you're going to look for what other avenues you've got. He might go the Higher Education Act compromise and settle authority path where he tries to do cancellation via a rulemaking process. He might try to do that. I would assume that a court would find the same path that he can't do that. If they're blocking it based on the HEROES Act, I would assume they would block it based on the Higher Education Act too. So if he can't go through that path to get relief for people, then what I might expect is he might go through the income-driven repayment plan and the public service loan forgiveness regulations and try to go that route instead. And so there's probably an internal discussion of how hard do you go? How intense do you go on these programs? Because the folks on the negotiated rulemaking committee, you know, asked for some super aggressive stuff. They wanted 400% of the poverty line for borrowers to, you know, before you had to make a payment. They were definitely interested in shorter timeframes to forgiveness, right? Like 7 years, 10 years. They were interested in cancellation every year through the IDR programs, and they were interested in lowering payments for people. And they were also interested in making sure that this new IDR plan, in every single case imaginable, would be the best plan and also in removing any barriers to borrowers switching out of old plans into this new plan so that the simplification of the student loan system could be accomplished by making one new plan that is so generous that every single person in the world would switch to it, and every single person who just checks that box, hey, put me on the plan with the lowest payment, would switch into that plan because, you know, there's now no interest capitalization unless you're leaving the IBR program or consolidating after July of 2023. And so that was the goal of negotiated rulemaking. And there's probably some moderate Democrats and career staffers in the Department of Education that might have pushed back on that a little bit and said, well, hey, like, let's take this half step of a Biden IDR plan that is going to be 5% of income for undergrads, 10% for grad students. It's going to be 20 years. It's going to be 10 years till forgiveness if you're basically having very small amounts of debt. And we're also going to expand the definition of public service loan forgiveness. And there's some different options that they're looking at. And here's kind of an interesting stat for you. I like to follow some of the different consumer advocate groups on Twitter. This picture is coming from Ben Kaufman, who I think it works for the Student Borrower Protection Center, I believe. Apologies, Ben, if I misstated that. But he's showing some different percentages of borrowers that could get PSLF and you know, with the different rules the Biden administration is considering. And they estimate that borrowers that borrowed for graduate degree holders before 2010, only 0.4% of them would have qualified for PSLF. That's because very few graduate borrowers would have only direct loans. Now, people that borrowed between 2011 and 2015, about 13% of graduate degree holders could qualify. 2016 to 2020, about 22% would qualify. 2021 and later, about 31% would qualify. Now, with the new regulations that they're looking at, one option is instead of 30% of graduate degree holders qualifying, going forward, about 34% would qualify for PSLF. So this is doing things like expanding the type of employers that could qualify, right? Like Kaiser Permanente, making certain kinds of adjunct faculty able to get this, right? Now, they're considering alternative scenarios too, where instead of 34% of graduate degree holders getting PSLF, 38% would get PSLF. What I'm trying to explain is that the administration can take a lot of little tweaking of the rules to back the truck up and try to get people as much forgiveness as possible without coming under fire as directly by all these lawsuits. Because here's something that's pretty obvious to me. The IDR waiver provides an ongoing incentive to consolidate. Absolutely, right? If you would say that the cancellation of 10 or 20,000 provides an incentive to consolidate, which, you know, the Department of Ed felt the need to rush to say if you consolidate on or after the state, you don't qualify, right? If you're looking at your portfolio of FFEL loans, getting 10 or 20K canceled if you consolidate certainly is a reason why somebody would do it. But the idea that you would get 15 years out of 20 years applied to your IBR plan or get your balance canceled completely, there's like $211 billion of loans that could be canceled with the IDR waiver, we estimate. And so that's probably at least half of the FFEL loan portfolio. And so that definitely provides an incentive to consolidate. But none of the Nebraska pension funds have sued over that. That's probably partly because they're focused on this cancellation thing first, and maybe partly because the rules of the IDR waiver haven't been published yet. But I think it's also because people want the glory of the headlines. You know, stopping the IDR waiver is kind of a niche kind of thing. It's not going to get you glory in conservative circles like stopping Biden's student loan cancellation might, I think. That's just my take. And so if the Biden administration goes super aggressive with regulations, with getting more people to qualify for PSLF, being more aggressive on how generous the IDR plan is, that stuff is probably not quite as subject to legal challenges and probably isn't as exciting for conservative groups to challenge. And so that's kind of the path forward, I think, for the administration that we might see. And it might be why we didn't see the rules for the IDR plan released like we were anticipating by November of 2022. I think that possibly what the goal was is to wait and see with this cancellation lawsuit barrage that they were getting, see how that shaked out. If I had to guess, this is a very speculative guess, so I apologize if this ends up being incorrect, but if I was the Biden administration, I would probably extend the pause on student loans until July of 2023. Why? It's because you could argue, well, that's because of all these lawsuits. We needed this to let borrowers that are struggling be able to have a better success of entering repayment by getting rid of the 10 and 20K balances that struggling borrowers are battling with the most. And so we want to get rid of this kind of balance. Then we can have people start repayments and we'll eventually give them a bit more generous IDR plan. But since you were not punished electorally from all the student loan relief that you were trying to do as the administration, ultimately, I don't think the administration cares about getting an extra 20 to 50 billion of student loan payment revenue back in the treasury, right? It's a fairly small amount of money compared to other initiatives. Why wouldn't you just extend it to July? I'm not saying that it will be. One of the issues is, you know, the story of, what is it, Chicken Little or the boy who cried wolf or something like that, right? If you say something once, people will believe you and then didn't happen. And then you might say it again and people might come out and say, okay, let's, you know, help. And then if you say something twice and you don't do it, people are really not going to believe you the third time. And if the administration does start payments in January, like they've said they will, I think that that's probably going to be the reason why they do it, is because they know that if they don't restart payments and tell people that it's not going to happen a second time, you know, then nobody's going to believe them when they say that payments actually do end up starting again. I don't know. It's hard to really estimate this stuff, but that's one path they could take, extending the pause until July 2023. I mean, obviously, we'll know for sure if they do start payments on January, or sorry, if they start interest on January 1st. They won't start payments until about January 30th, but they would start interest January 1st. And so when that happens, we know for sure that, you know, payments definitely are starting up again, right? The first day of interest being charged is the time that we know it's going to be the case. And then the other thing that we're looking for is the draft release of the IDR plan rules. Now, they've already come out and said what the parameters are going to be, but they haven't released the proposed language yet, which means that they could respond to this lawsuit, you know, against cancellation by saying, well, we have no choice because of what these Republicans are trying to do to harm borrowers than to come out with an even more generous program through the existing IDR authority that we have in Department of Ed, to go even bigger and provide even more relief directly for borrowers through the income-based repayment programs. And if you have a very small Republican majority in Congress, or even a Democratic majority in Congress, in the House, then probably there's nothing they can really do to stop that. Perhaps that pandemic health emergency doesn't get suspended now for a while longer, and so you might be able to move things around, make rules a lot more aggressive. Who knows? So I do think that the new IDR plan, regardless, is going to be available sometime at the earliest in December 2023, because they did not publish the rules by November 1st of 2022. So they might use some bureaucratic maneuvering to get it released early, like they did with the repay program. Generally, you're supposed to have the language released and finished up by November 1st of the prior year to have it taken into effect July the following year. And so for that reason, I don't think we would necessarily see that Biden plan by until maybe the end of 2023, or maybe at worst until July of 2024. And that's another reason why, if there was a Republican takeover in 2024 of the White House, you know, if they did the negotiated rulemaking and they got all the language together by November 2025, the very earliest you could take away the Biden plan would be July of 2026. And most likely they couldn't get everything put together by then. So that means July 2027. And if that were to happen, with the new rules on giving, you know, weighted average credit after a consolidation that are coming after July of 2023, it might actually be a smart idea to consolidate again and get that new Biden IDR plan in your promissory note, just in case, you know, Republican administration comes down the line and takes that program away. Remember, what we think is, if it's in your promissory note, you've got it and they can't take it away. That's what we think. And if you look at the repay and the pay programs, anybody who's done a consolidation or borrowed loans since 2016 has that language in their promissory notes. Anybody who's borrowed since 2014 has got the new IDR plan in their promissory note, and that's a program that would require 60 votes in the Senate to overturn. And so the new IDR program, if you've borrowed for the first time after July 2014, you're set no matter what anybody does in the future, because there's no way that they would repeal new IDR unless they had a supermajority in the Senate and the White House, Republicans did, and this obviously doesn't seem like that's going to happen anytime soon. So there's a lot going on with student loans right now. We might have some of the other team members on the pod, because I'm going to be deep in handling dad duties here for the next couple to several months. We've got baby coming home from the NICU, so I'm going to be pretty, going to have my hands full. And we will do our very best to come out with the latest breaking updates on student loan stuff so that you know. If you have any questions about any of this, we'd love to hear from our listeners. You just go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. You can use, you do this on a phone. You just go to type it in studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. If you type it into your browser, it's going to take you to a spot where you can press that record button and ask your question. I'm going to not always get things right. So I just want to say that I do not have a perfect hit rate. I don't think anybody that is involved in something that's very uncertain can have a perfect hit rate. Again, sorry that I missed on the Texas lawsuit. That kind of came out of left field. Everybody was looking at the Eighth Circuit. Pretty much nobody anticipated that the Fifth Circuit was going to be important in this student loan cancellation battle. And regardless of what happens, I think for the rest of the year, we're going to see battles over this. It's going to get appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, hey, this is not something that you can do. Then I think we will see the Biden administration that is not chastened from a bad midterm result, right, is going to continue to go big in the relief they're providing borrowers through executive action. And the reason why that's kind of important is because they're doing it through executive action, it's going to be more complicated, it's going to be more involved, the rules are going to be more confusing, and ultimately the rules in some cases could be taken away depending on if somebody else takes over the White House in 2024 or 2028. So one of the things that we're going to be doing in our consults is just looking at, hey, this is what the Biden plan looks like, this is what the existing plans look like, and if you had sort of an effort to remove all of the executive student loan relief actions, what would you qualify for that's just based on the statute, which is generally old IBR or new IBR? We're going to be trying to stay nimble and look at all this for you. Hope folks ask questions via the voicemail line, and then if you, have any need for a consult right now, specifically people that have any of these older types of loans, lots of forbearances or deferments, we're telling people to consolidate with the IDR waiver. There's some cases where you would not consolidate, but you should definitely get help with the IDR waiver. This is people that have long-term deferments or forbearances, people that have loans they borrowed over very different numbers of years, people that have got loans that were not paused during the pandemic, and people that just in general want to understand what this IDR waiver means for them. If you could save money, it's like generally 100 times our consult fee. So it's sort of like if somebody could show up to look at your plumbing and prevent maybe a 75-80% chance that they're going to find a mistake about your plumbing that's $50,000 plus in savings. And worst case scenario, they come out for a few hundred bucks and they don't find anything that you need to change, in which case you get peace of mind knowing that there's nothing that's going to burst and go wrong. I mean, that's how we model things. You know, if you think about some attorneys, they do contingency fees and you take a percent of the savings. If we did that, a whole lot of our fees would be in the thousands of dollars for people. And that's not a good consumer-friendly model, in my opinion, when, you know, we're doing things the way we do them. That's why we charge the way we charge. You know, some people prefer a contingency fee, but like, again, that's, we think that if you're going to be charging people a percent of the savings or something, that's just not a consumer-friendly model, in my opinion. So if you need the help, studentloanplanner.com/book. Our team is doing lots of consults right now, specifically around the IDR waiver. And also, you know, if you wanted to look at what the Biden IDR plan would mean for your loan payments when they start up and how much you might be able to save through that, if that could be a better alternative than paying back your loans, we're also doing a lot of that as well. So any questions, leave a question on the voicemail line. Thank you much for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast.